Funding for WPLN News comes from you, our listeners, and Bernstein Private Wealth, working with creators and innovators to invest with intention and build the legacy they want to leave behind. More at Bernstein.com.
I'm LaTanya Turner, and this is Nashville. I'm filling in for host Khalil Ekolona, and you'll get to hear some other new voices on the show during the next few weeks as Khalil takes his first ever sabbatical, but he'll be back soon. This hour, we're talking about homelessness, specifically some innovative strategies to prevent and end it. It's part of our special monthly series, In My Place. And to get us started today, we'll hear from someone who has a lot of experience with what works and what doesn't work when it comes to solving homelessness. Jeff Olive is the executive director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, which coordinates homelessness solutions at the national level on behalf of the White House. Jeff joins us remotely from his office in D.C. Welcome to This is Nashville, Jeff.
It's great to be with you, LaTanya.
Good. You started out as an outreach worker, literally on the streets, connecting with unhoused people. How did you get involved with this work?
That's right. I spent a number of years doing direct service work. I was an outreach worker as part of a healthcare outreach team. I was a case manager in housing programs and spent a number of years doing the real hands-on work. I'd done some work overseas and came back to the States and realized there was just as much deep poverty and just as much crisis to deal with here as there is anywhere in the world. When you get down to an individual level of someone who has lost their home, who's often lost connection to family and friends and community, the work here is vital. And that was about 30 years ago. And, you know, here we are.
Kind of disturbing that you were overseas doing this work and maybe thought things would be better when you came here.
Well, deep poverty is similar no matter where you are. If you're destitute, if you're without a roof over your head, if you don't know where your next meal is going to come from, that's a life and death crisis, no matter whether you're in the wealthiest nation on earth or one of the poorer nations. It's the trauma, the fear, the disconnection is true at a very human level.
So true. We're going to talk some more about that in a few minutes. But first, tell us about the federal agency you lead. What is the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness?
We're an independent federal agency that coordinates policy across the entire federal government related to preventing and ending homelessness. We bring together the power of 19 federal agencies. The heads of those agencies, cabinet secretaries, and other administrators serve as our basically our board of directors. They serve on our council, and we work very closely with the White House and those 19 member agencies to make sure that the federal response to homelessness is as strategic, as focused, and as collaborative as possible.
And those 19 agencies and the federal response are the support system for troops on the ground, so to speak.
That's right. We work very closely with local leaders, with local homeless service providers. We meet regularly with people experiencing homelessness themselves to make sure that our federal response is as relevant as possible at the local level.
Okay. I want to get back to something you touched on earlier about some of the crises that can lead to homelessness. And, you know, unfortunately, many of us make assumptions about why someone is homeless, why we see someone sleeping on the street. What are some of the misconceptions you try to quash?
At its root, homelessness is a housing crisis in this nation. 50 years ago, we had a surplus of affordable housing, and today we have a deficit of 7.3 million units of affordable housing. We've dug ourselves into a very deep hole around housing affordability and housing availability.
That must have been a really long time ago.
Well, I think that disinvestment began in the early 70s and has continued. We've lost a lot of affordable housing units that just weren't protected along the way, and then we haven't developed fast enough to keep up with a growing population and growing demands. And so housing remains out of reach for a lot of people.
Okay. So bottom line, at its core, you're saying homelessness is a housing crisis because of a lack of affordable housing. But there are other things that often are associated with homelessness. You mentioned trauma, poverty, those kinds of things. Help us better understand the reasons that someone winds up unhoused.
Well, I think there are a lot of individual risk factors for homelessness, and I'll talk about a few of those, but I think it's important to differentiate between the structural factors, like how expensive housing is and how few units there are available to people as a kind of root cause of homelessness, and then the individual risk factors that put people at higher risk of becoming homeless. And those are things like domestic violence, generational poverty, people who are wrestling with mental illness and substance use certainly have higher risk of homelessness. So do people with disabilities, people who have a medical crisis that causes them to lose their job, lose their home. And so these individual vulnerabilities or risk factors are who determine, they determine who becomes homeless. I don't think of those as root causes of homelessness. Now, those issues often get worse once people are on the street or in the shelter. Mental health crises get exacerbated. People have a hard time dealing with addiction and treating medical conditions and things like that. So it's important that we address both the structural housing crisis and the individual wraparound supports that people need while they're homeless. And certainly as we help folks exit into housing, we need to make sure that the wraparound supports are in place to help them be successful.
Okay. Speaking of wraparound supports, one of the solutions we're focusing on today is Housing First. Tell us what that philosophy is.
Housing First is both a philosophy and a program model. It's a way of doing housing and services that meets people where they are and helps them exit homelessness and remain housed. It's built on a foundational belief that housing is a human right, and housing is the fundamental foundation from which people can address all sorts of other challenges they're facing. It's very hard if someone's homeless, if they're living in their vehicle, living in a shelter, living on the streets or in an encampment. It's very difficult to get a job and keep a job, to stay healthy medically, to address depression or psychosis or trauma that people have experienced. It's very difficult for survivors of domestic violence and human trafficking and sexual assault to stay safe. The streets and the shelters are just not the kind of emotional and physical safety that people need to thrive. And so what Housing First does is work to move people as quickly as possible from homelessness into a safe place of their own and provide very good wraparound supports that they can access to maintain that housing. I think one of the misconceptions, LaTanya, is that Housing First means housing only, and that's just not true. It's not about putting people into an apartment and crossing our fingers. It's about getting people into a safe home and providing those wraparound supports that help them stay housed.
I'm glad you mentioned that because, yes, I think that the term is a little bit misleading because it does, at first, until you understand it, imply get them in the house, get them in a structure, but there's more to it. Who does benefit from this? Who does Housing First work for?
Let me go back in time just a little bit. When I started in this work, we didn't have Housing First. It was just beginning to develop in the mid-90s, had not become widespread across the nation. And the approach that we were taking then was to make people jump through a lot of hoops to kind of earn their housing. I say earn in air quotes there. We had sobriety requirements that people had to be off of drugs and alcohol for 6 months before they could move into housing, or they had to be actively taking medications if they were wrestling with a mental health issue. And it just didn't work very well. We were putting up a lot of barriers, I think inadvertently. I think there was a mindset that this is what people needed. It was about housing readiness. When Housing First came along, it was transformative because what we learned is that people who maybe we never thought would be able to succeed in housing were succeeding in housing. And that includes people with serious mental illness, people with very severe addiction to drugs and alcohol, people with disabilities, with chronic medical conditions. And so if you look at the evidence that has grown up around Housing First, it really does work for those highly complex populations, folks who have a lot stacked against them. As long as we can provide stable housing and good wraparound supports, it works very well for the vast majority of folks who are homeless.
It seems like it's really about providing that shelter, but meeting people where they are. I mean, you have to address those needs as well.
You know, every pathway into homelessness is different, and every pathway out of homelessness is different. People are complex. People are nuanced. People have their own strengths, their own challenges. We all do. And whether, you know, however somebody found themselves in homelessness, the experience of exiting homelessness and the supports that people might need look very different for different people.
Speaking of that, who doesn't benefit from Housing First philosophy? I mean, are there some who this doesn't work for?
The best evidence shows that Housing First works for something like 80 to 85% of people who are involved if the model is done to fidelity. And what I mean by that is that if you follow the model as the research has shown it to work, it works very well for about 4 in 5 people who receive Housing First. What that says to me is that there are some folks who it's not working for. And, you know, that might be just crises they're facing in their life. It might be that they're just not able to maintain that housing. Maybe they're not accessing the supports that are available to them. And so I think we do need to carve out new territory and figure out new models that work for people who are not being served well by Housing First programs. But that doesn't mean throwing out the stuff that's working. And it feels like the national and local conversations about Housing First have become very political, very partisan, very much either or kind of thinking. And we've got to have both and kind of thinking. We need to keep the things that are working well, and we need to also develop new models. And that's going to require coming together across political lines. It's going to require bringing together the public sector and the private sector, the homeless service providers and businesses and faith community, local and federal leaders, and first and foremost, people who have experienced homelessness themselves need to be part of the decision-making and policy-making.
Okay, I want to back up to something you talked about in terms of it working 80 to 85% if it's done as modeled. What are some of the missteps that people make, or maybe even the misuses of this concept that can feed into that possibility of it not being effective?
Well, I think it's, I would call them challenges, not necessarily missteps. I think a lot of the housing and service providers are doing a great job with what they have, but there are a couple of realities. One is we simply don't have enough units. We don't have enough slots for people. And part of that is around the funding for it. We need to grow the pie, both nationally and locally, to pay for the housing, but also to pay for the services. And often what we see is even if someone has a voucher and can get into housing, it's very difficult for local providers to finance the wraparound supports that are actually going to be essential to helping people stay housed. And so as we think about scaling the model, we need to focus on the housing side and on the supportive services side. And I think sometimes that gets lost in the conversation.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, this is Nashville, and I'm LaTanya Turner. We're talking this hour about Housing First as a solution to homelessness. This series is thanks in part to support from Pinnacle Financial Partners. We're talking right now with Jeff Olivet, the Executive Director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. Jeff, you mentioned partisanship and politics and a lot of other barriers. Is there widespread acceptance of Housing First? Is there pushback also?
Both are true, I think. When Housing First became kind of national policy, that was under a Republican administration. That was under the George W. Bush administration. My agency at the time, I was not in government at that point, but the U.S. Interagency Council and others began really talking about the importance of Housing First. That was in the mid-2000s.
And a Republican administration.
And a Republican administration. And there have been approaches that have had bipartisan support within Congress around housing homeless veterans, for example, through a Housing First mindset. So I think what I'd like people to know is that this has been a bipartisan approach until recent years. And now it has really become politicized. And my assessment of that is that some of that is that people know that we've been doing Housing First for 15 years at the national level, and they still see homelessness. And in many communities, homelessness is growing, and they might blame the current policy for that. But it's a, I think, a real misunderstanding of what's actually going on. What we know is that Housing First works really well at the individual level. It helps individuals and families move out of homelessness into housing. What it doesn't do is solve the larger structural issues around housing affordability, housing supply, scaling up mental health care and substance use treatment. It is designed as an individual level intervention, and yet we're expecting it to do all things, including prevent homelessness, which Housing First was never designed to do. And so we need to pair it with an upstream prevention strategy that begins to stem inflow into homelessness.
It seems like this affordable housing portion of the conversation is so important to this. And we talk about it so much. I mean, we've done plenty of reporting on affordable housing here in Middle Tennessee. It seems like people just kind of maybe have gotten immune to that factor contributing to this problem. How do you convince others that that is key to resolving homelessness?
In the 1930s, we had homelessness on a scale that we haven't seen before or since in this country. And then between 1940 and 1970, the nation invested heavily in housing as infrastructure. And we saw homelessness recede into the woodwork. It essentially almost went away. There was a little bit of homelessness in large cities, but certainly nothing like we see now. And then, as I said earlier, in 1970, we began pulling federal funding out of housing, investing in less housing affordability, not continuing to develop the housing that's affordable for very low-income people. And we've seen homelessness rise as a result. In 1970, we had mental illness, we had substance use, we had domestic violence, we had a lot of these other factors that play into homelessness, but we didn't have homelessness on the scale that we have it now, because we weren't in the housing crisis that we find ourselves in today. So again, it's both and thinking. You can't solve homelessness with only housing. It's got to be housing and really good supports for people. But certainly we can't solve homelessness unless we address the fundamental housing challenge.
Well, and it's not only pulling funding from housing. I mean, let's talk about a darker aspect of this, which is the idea of criminalization of homelessness in some cities as an approach to solving the problem. I mean, Tennessee is one state that has a fairly recent law making it a felony to camp on public property, which, of course, is aimed at unhoused people. So I would assume you would say these laws are totally misdirected, but let's talk about that and what is being done to redirect that focus.
Punishing people for their homelessness by arresting them, citing them, fining them, potentially putting them in jail does nothing to solve homelessness. And in fact, it's counterproductive. It keeps people from being able to exit homelessness, because now, above all the other challenges they might have been facing, now they have a criminal record that's going to work against them as they try to get a job, get a home, convince a landlord to rent to them after a period of not having a home. And so it's not only that it's neutral, that it doesn't solve homelessness, it's actually working against our ability to solve homelessness. These laws are also expensive to implement. We're spending a lot of money on policing and courts and jail time that could be diverted into housing and services, the things that we actually know work. And then I believe that laws that make it illegal to exist in public spaces in a city or a state, I believe these are deeply inhumane. It is not about the person. It's about punishing the person and blaming them for their homelessness, as if homelessness is a choice, as if people who are living outside under a bridge or in a very dangerous encampment are choosing that. They're ending up there because they have no other options. And I think that's a mindset shift that we need to create a much more compassionate and humane response to this crisis.
Okay. I guess the good thing is some of these laws don't seem to be getting any traction, and there have been some challenges. So we'll have to see where all that plays out. Before we wrap up, you mentioned that, I believe I understood you to say that it's not really possible to eradicate homelessness. Am I misquoting you there? Let's restate that.
Let me correct that that misconception too, because I believe down to my core that it is possible to end homelessness in this nation. We have addressed enormous challenges as a nation. If you look at our more than two centuries of history, we've had a lot of problems. We've made a lot of bad policy missteps. We've had we've not always done things well. But I'll give one example. We decided as a nation 150 years ago that every child should have an education, and we created the public school system. Now, I'm a product of the public school system just south of your border there in Tennessee. I grew up in Alabama. Okay. And, you know, education hasn't been perfect. It's had a lot of racial segregation to it. We've had separate and unequal schools at points. But we as a nation decided that every child should have an education. Mm-hmm. We could make the same policy decision around housing. We could say housing is a basic fundamental human right, and we're going to invest in it so that no one has to experience homelessness in the richest nation in the history of the world.
I see. We should distinguish between prevention and eradication. It may not can be prevented, correct, but we can eradicate it with some of those strategies.
I think it's possible to eradicate it altogether.
Okay. All right. Very enlightening conversation, Jeff. We need to take a break, but Jeff Olivet, thanks for joining us to start this conversation about Housing First. And when we come back, we're going to take a deeper look at Housing First and solving homelessness with three guests who are on the front lines of implementing this strategy. We'll be right back. This is Nashville. I'm LaTanya Turner, and this is Nashville. Before the break, we heard from Jeff Olivet, the White House homelessness czar, who told us about the value of Housing First. It's an approach to housing people experiencing homelessness that includes providing the needed wraparound services. We're now going to hear from three local guests about how Nashville is doing when it comes to implementing Housing First. But before that, we visit the new Wallace Studios off I-24 near Harding Place. It's getting a lot of attention as a potential solution for homelessness. Adam Rosenberg of AGB Real Estate has converted a two-story motel into 131 studio apartments. These are permanent supported housing units meant to be a step into a permanent home for a single person or a couple. One-year leases for the fully furnished studios include utilities, water, electric, and Wi-Fi, and go for just over $1,400 a month. More than 75% of the units have been leased, 90% of those with voucher assistance. Move-in day will be in April. One big feature of the property is that it will help provide support services to residents, something we talked quite a bit about with Jeff Olivet in our first segment. That includes working with community organizations to provide on-site medical care and food assistance, having a computer lab with computer literacy training available, nighttime security, and perhaps most notably, having a full-time peer support specialist living on-site to help residents navigate everything from finding recovery resources to filling out paperwork for support services, or just being able to talk. The on-site peer support specialist was not in the original plan, but given the need, the developer decided to support the idea and has donated a unit for the position. This is Nashville producer Catherine Ceces went to an open house at the property last week and spoke with Adam Rosenberg. Adam is an established developer who is working with a partner who has over a decade of experience in permanent supported housing. But this is Rosenberg's first project in the space. He gave Catherine a tour of one of the newly renovated studios and spoke about the decision to add a peer support specialist to the community. Take a listen.
So the rooms are all about 260 square feet. It may sound small, but as you can see, we're standing in it and there's sufficient space for to be really comfortable. We have a queen bed and a love seat, which can seat two people comfortably, a coffee table, a dinner table that is very efficient, has two seats in it that can pull out and be stored for efficiency's sake when they're not using it. We're really proud of the appliance package that we put together. So all stainless steel appliances. You have a standard size fridge, dishwasher, a hot plate, which has two burners on it, a convection microwave, which acts as a oven as well. So our philosophy is that we develop and we put items into the rooms that we would want ourselves. So that's why we put stainless steel appliances, we put granite countertops, and dishwasher. I hate washing dishes. And we're trying to solve the pain points that everyday people have. So we just stepped into the bathroom. I would like to point out their new hardwood floors that we're standing on. The bathroom has a tub and a shower. They have a vanity, obviously a toilet, and this is the closet area where they'll use to store their stuff. This has really been a conversation and a listening experience for me to understand what the community needs here. So I was invited to one of the homeless council meetings in January as a story of success. And I really learned that one of the most difficult times for someone who has experienced homelessness or is housing challenged is they lose their community when they move into a new space. Typically that may be in an apartment building where they don't know anyone and they feel like certainly a stranger, but also not like they don't have the people, there are people around them. And so one of the most dangerous times is when they first move in because they feel lonely and that can lead to some harmful behaviors for themselves. So when I heard that, it made perfect sense to me to dedicate and donate one of our rooms to a peer support, trained and certified peer support specialist on site who can be an advocate and a listener for someone who is coming here for the first time, maybe may not know how to navigate living alone for the first time. There's a lot of things that you and I may not think about because it's second nature to us that is new to some of the individuals that might be here. So we wanted to create as strong as a support system as possible to give this community the best chance possible. And then we want to do more. So that's why we had this open house to listen again to what suggestions and concerns that people have here.
That's such an innovative program. And joining us now to give some insight into this kind of development is India Pongarcher. She's a local advocate and outreach specialist with Open Table Nashville. She's also been keeping up with this project, the Wallace Studios. Welcome to This is Nashville, India.
Thank you for having me back.
Certainly. What do you see as the pros and cons of a development like this in addressing homelessness?
For sure. Well, first, just wanted to throw out the caveat that in my ideal version of our world, housing would not be a commodity. But so with that in mind, and back to the reality of our society, I will say that I think one of the successes and one of the most exciting things about the Wallace Road property is that we do have a developer that is invested in Nashville. He's coming to Metro, he's coming to service providers, and he's saying, hey, this is a need, and I want to fill that need. Let me listen to y'all, and how can we make this need disappear or mitigate it together? And so I think that's been really encouraging because I've witnessed him listen and, like the story said, take feedback and act on that. And I think including a peer support program at this property is just one example of it. So I think that's super encouraging. But I do think it's a step in the right direction, certainly. But also there's room for improvement. I've seen the units. They're beautiful. But I don't think we're going to address our housing crisis holistically, you know, with just studio apartments, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that it just speaks to the need that we have to continue to be employing all different options and solutions we have on the table. And we definitely need more 1, 2, 3, 4 bedroom units. So I hope that
They are families.
For sure. For sure. We know we have 500 families that we've identified at least that are waiting for services in Nashville right now. And so I'd love to be able to include some of those folks in development projects that are happening. And I hope that developers like Adam can continue to think creatively, tap into diverse funding streams so that we can get, you know, larger units online in Nashville for anybody that's experiencing and trying to exit homelessness.
I do like the concept of building community. And for I sure. think that's something that people don't think about maybe when they're just like, well, let's get somebody in a house. Well, if you're in a house in a place where you don't have any connections and you can't interact with other people, then you lose something. So I think that is important to that. Is that a useful thing you find?
Absolutely. I think that the conversation, you know, we have ideas and we have some experience as a city providing wraparound services. But I think the next step of that conversation that, you know, we've been starting to hear on the ground is exactly like you said, okay, we move people in, they have their basic needs met, but there's still something missing. And oftentimes that is that, you know, sense of community and connection, those relationships that, you know, people are starting over in building when they move into an apartment, you know, from the streets from a shelter.
Okay. Thanks, India. Now, we have some other guests in our studio. I'm going to introduce them right now. David Langle-Martin and Paula Carlson are with us. David is the Chief Housing Officer of Park Center, a local nonprofit that implements Housing First. And Paula lives in a housing unit at Park Center. Thank you both for joining us. This is Nashville Today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Good. David, Wallace Studios, as we were talking about a few minutes ago with India, is a new model where a private developer is stepping into an arena that typically is served by nonprofits, charities. What do you think about that idea of the private sector involvement in permanent supportive housing?
I love to see that. It's going to take all of us coming together to solve this issue. Any kind of community collaboration and private investment in this industry is welcome as far as I'm concerned. And I also appreciate that they've taken the time to listen and make some adjustments and kind of course correct as they've gone through to be sure that they're actually meeting the needs of the people in our community and not just, you know, going based off their assumptions.
That's an important thing because, you know, and having a private investor just throwing money into a concept, but it may not be the concept that people need and want. So it sounds like they're doing that at Wallace Studios.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that one of the things that we're going to run into the challenge there is having so many people concentrated in one spot. And so again, to India's point about building community, we have to find ways to integrate that group of people into the community around them. And just think about all the folks who may have had community elsewhere who have now been pulled out of that environment and are now trying to find new community in their new home.
At Park Center, how are you implementing Housing First?
Sure. For us, it all starts with building a relationship. It's really important that people have trust and are able to be honest both ways. So we really try to start off by subverting people's expectations and kind of surprising them in how we deliver service. I want people to have the experience when they first see their apartment, wow, this is amazing, this is beautiful, I can't believe this. Or
we have a dishwasher,
that's
like
right.
We heard
that's
in
exactly
the first
right.
piece.
Yeah, I couldn't believe how quickly I was able to move in. And, you know, even the service providers in some cases have burned people, you know, and haven't been able to follow through on the promises that they've delivered. So we really try not to promise anything we can't follow through on. But building those relationships, I'll never forget a woman who moved in not too long ago when she was signing her lease, asked me to take her picture.
Oh.
And it was because she never thought for the rest of her life she would live in an apartment. And those are things we all take for granted. I've never wanted to remember a lease signing before, but it was such a life-defining moment for her. And it just shows we don't understand a lot of times what people are bringing with them when they walk in the door.
Yes, yes. I'm sure it's very memorable for people who are moving into a place that they can call their own with some community. And to tell us more about that, Paula, you're a renter in Park Center's housing program, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
So how long have you been connected to Park Center?
I've been connected to Park Center for about a year and a half now.
Okay. Tell us, go ahead.
And they had literally picked me up off the ground beside a building and put me in a motel room, and the next day I had my apartment.
Can you relate to what David was saying about that feeling of joy and wanting to capture the moment?
Yes, yes, you can. It was amazing. I mean, I didn't know what I was going to do at first. I knew I was in contact with Park Center, but that was waiting on them, trying to figure out what they wanted to do, mm-hmm. which way they was going to go. Mm-hmm. And then that's whenever they got hold of me and said, hey, we got you.
And you were still pleasantly surprised, I'm assuming.
Yes, I was very pleasantly surprised.
What was the pathway like for you to get to Park Center? Tell us a little about that.
It was hard. I was homeless. I had been homeless, and I was out there doing my thing that I was doing, and it was really hard. Because, I mean, you're wanting help. You're out there, you're really wanting to help. But sometimes you don't know which way to turn to get the help mm-hmm. that you need.
Can you help us understand a little bit more? Are you comfortable telling us a little bit more about the triggers for you that landed you as an unhoused person?
It was due to losing a fiancé. And then losing interest in everything that I had, that I didn't care no more, that I would prefer to have been out on the streets with the homeless than having a home because I didn't have nobody there with me in the home. Mm-hmm. I was lonely. And like you guys saying, you do get lonely. Mm-hmm. And I was lonely. So I lost my house when I lost my apartment. I became one of the homeless ones. You know, sleeping under bridges, sleeping in tents and whatever, or in vacant homes or whatever you can find. I've been out there, done it, and now thank God for Park Center pulling me out of that rut and putting me in a place where I do have stabilization and I do have the connections that I need, that I have. So, I mean, they've really pulled me out of a rut. They've got me in contact with my family that I haven't seen in 27 years.
Oh, that's awesome.
They got me in contact with my son, my brother, and my sister.
I'm so glad to hear that this has been successful for you so far.
Yes.
Thank you for telling us about that. And I'm wondering, I'm assuming now that you do have more of a joy for trying to live and set some goals for yourself. So now yes. that you have housing compared to when you were still struggling and on the streets, tell us how things are different.
Things are different by I'm going back to school to get my GED. And if I want to look for a job, they'll help me find a job. Or if I want to go into the day programs, I can go into the day programs.
You're getting a lot of calls today, Paula. Okay. So you're working on your GED.
Mm-hmm.
That's a
yes,
big
ma'am.
Step.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell me what prompted you to do that.
My son. When I found out that he had went to college and become an attorney and that he proved himself that Mama, now it's time to prove herself.
Okay.
Time for me to get myself on the ball.
Okay. Well, we wish you well. Let us know when you graduate.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, this is Nashville, and I'm LaTanya Turner. We're talking this hour about the Housing First philosophy of addressing homelessness. This series is thanks in part to support from Pinnacle Financial Partners, and we're talking with three people with hands-on experience with the Housing First philosophy, and one of them is India, and we want to talk some with you about your work with Open Table. Tell us a little bit about that and how Housing First relates to that.
So Open Table Nashville is an interfaith grassroots outreach organization. We've been around since about 2010, and we have housing navigators, street outreach workers that go out into the community and literally meet people where they're at, as Jeff was talking about, and basically meet with folks and try to determine, you know, what is their need or what is the first item that they want to work on. So we try to build a relational approach with folks and work on things like housing, making sure folks have any sort of, you know, camping supply they need while they're staying outside, but really making sure that the individual is telling us how we can best work with them and serve them together.
You said meet people where they are and let them tell you what they need. So in some cases, maybe that's not a house right away?
It might not be. I think that, you know, other folks have brought up that relational component and how important it is to build trust between someone and their caseworker. And so maybe, you know, might need a little bit of time in order to give what's really personal and vulnerable information that service providers need in order to start someone on the housing process. And so everyone's situation and trajectory and journey is a little bit different. But yeah, we try to be, patient with folks and let them, again, tell us how we can best support them in addressing whatever need that they want to work on first. And a lot of times that does turn into, you know, working towards permanent housing. But that journey just takes a little bit of different amount of time for each person.
You seem to have a pretty good grasp of housing first, but do you feel like our community in general implements it well?
I think that we are working towards that. We obviously have organizations, you know, like Park Center, and I think that that's the closest model we have towards reaching that, you know, housing first fidelity again that Jeff was talking about. We've made strides as a community through Metro over the years when we've, you know, had this $50 million investment in housing, transitional housing options, as well as support services. But I think that, you know, there's still room for improvement and things that we have to work out as a community. And those things look like, you know, making sure those support services are online and ramped up, you know, before we're moving folks into transitional and permanent units so that there's not a lag. And so we're not putting folks into units that do need those wraparound services and need those right away, so there's just not a delay in, you know, the time that someone signs a lease and moves in to when they're getting reconnected with a caseworker that specifically focuses on retention.
Okay. And David, we have just about a minute, but how do you feel we're doing with implementing Housing First?
I would agree with India's assessment. Recently, Metro brought a national expert in for a conference who spoke about Housing First. And one of the things that he said I thought was interesting is that we have all the ingredients we need here to implement the model. We have a mayor who's committed to housing first and building off of past progress, but we still have room to grow in terms of we need someone who can see the person through the entire process. We need to steward landlord relationships when we've spent so much time up front getting them involved. We need to make sure they stay involved. Mm-hmm. And then we need to do community collaboration across all organizations. And that has to be at some level led by the city. The programs aren't all going to serve the same population or follow the same model or even implement Housing First. And that's good because it's not for everyone, but they have to be working in tandem. And that has to be organized by the city.
Very good. Everybody needs to be on the same page. And I know that all of you are going to do your part to make sure that happens. Thank you so much for joining us today. We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll get some feedback from a special guest who has lived experience with homelessness. John, join the conversation by tweeting us at This Is Nashville, and we'll be right back. I'm LaTanya Turner, and this is Nashville. We're ending our first episode by bringing on a special guest, Deirdre Childress. She's a former guest on the show and also has lived experience. We asked her to listen to today's episode and give us some live feedback by answering three questions. Thanks for being here, Deirdre.
Thank you for having me.
What is one thing you learned from this episode?
In 1930, that was the largest scale for homelessness. That kind of shocked me.
Me too.
Yeah. So that was one of the things I learned today.
Okay. Anything else?
President Bush, he was really for the housing crisis. And yeah, that shocked me too.
Yeah. I commented to that when I
know.
Heard it.
I was like, wow, awesome. Because you don't hear a lot of great things about Bush.
Okay. We'll save that for another show, okay?
Yes, ma'am.
What is something you disagree with?
$1,400 is affordable housing. That was the biggest. My mouth dropped.
Yeah.
For a 226 square foot unit, $1,400.
Yeah.
And of course, we're dealing with a population where people are really struggling and are trying to be secure and safe. Mm-hmm. And if you're only making minimum wage or even $20 an hour, it's pretty hard to afford $1,400 a month. And that's with food, you need clothing, you know, unless you're getting all these services for free. And that really doesn't happen here in Tennessee.
Do you think it makes a difference if there, I mean, some of the residents do have vouchers, mm-hmm. as we stated, and also the wraparound services. So does that, do you think, make it a little more doable?
Well, the wraparound service is perfect, I believe, right? But what if you don't have a Section 8 voucher?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then we know with this state, we have seen that most people that get vouchers, they're pushing them out to the outskirts. So I was happy to hear that they're making opportunities and places for people to reside still in Davidson County, because a lot of our folks have been pushed out. But still, if you don't have a Section 8 voucher, really, can you afford $1,400 a month for 226 square feet?
You heard that part, didn't you?
Yeah.
and you mentioned people being pushed out, but even the surrounding areas now
are very expensive.
Yes.
It is. But another thing that I disagree with is the Housing First model. To me, the Housing First model here in Nashville doesn't work, and it needs to be eradicated altogether. We need to bring some younger folks, some younger blood, some swifter minds to come together and create a new model.
Okay.
I just don't think it worked for us. And Mr. Oliver said it works, the model works when you're using 4 to 5 people. Let's be real. 4 to 5 people getting housed at a time, that is very low numbered.
Mm-hmm.
So I was disappointed to hear that. I was thinking he was going to say 400 to 500 people it worked for, but he said actually 4 to 5.
Okay. You have some very strong opinions about this. So one final thing before we go, what would you like to hear more about in upcoming episodes?
More solutions and more ways to come together to create a new Housing First model for Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay. And do you have one quick suggestion you'd make?
I would. I would like to add more organizations and more churches.
Tell me about that.
To create programming and social services. So I love the idea of them having peer support specialists, but we still need common people on the front line that's serving and fighting for people, because people need support. So if we don't have those support people in place, you feel alone. You feel left.
What did you think about what David said about people kind of being fragmented and needing to work more together? Do you think that's part of the reason you don't feel that there's enough services out there? Everybody's kind of siloed.
Right. Everybody's doing their own thing. Nobody's coming together. So, yeah, I agree with David. If we could just get more people to come together, and not about the dollar. You have to have people that's come together for the heart, for the people. And that's the problem.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to tell us before we wrap up?
We do need more units for families.
Yes.
And that's very heartening that nobody's creating a model to incorporate families. And we do have over 500 families that's needing services. When I was in the Hunting House population, it was me and 5 children. And that's why I slept in my car, because I couldn't even take my son with me and my daughters to the shelter. So we need more people like me, like you, and that's on higher level in government places that can collaborate and come up with better ideas to house more people at one time.
Yes, and families are and children being unhoused is a growing problem. And just want to clarify one thing that I believe it was Jeff Olive said, 4 out of 5 people benefit
right
from housing first.
From housing.
Okay.
At a time. And right. That is very low scale.
Well, but 4 out of 5. Well, we'll do the math later.
Oh, he said 4 out of 5.
Yes.
Oh, so I heard it wrong when I was listening. Okay, because I thought he said 4 to 5 people. So if he's saying 4 out of 5, I guess to him that's a good model, right? 4 out of 5 people. But what I've learned on my own.
That's still a majority.
That's still a majority, but I don't think that's right.
Okay.
Because the model that we use here in Nashville, Tennessee, it just haven't been working for some of the organizations that's using it and trying to create these safe spaces. Okay, I just think it need to be revamped. So sorry, Jeff. I can take
Well,
that.
We got the math right before we ended, so yes, our ma'am. Listeners have the right information. Thanks a lot, Deirdre.
I still don't agree.
Okay. Major point.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you to all our guests, Jeff Olivet, India Pongarcher, David Langle-Martin, Paula Carlson, and Deirdre, who's here in the studio with me, Deirdre Childress. Thanks for tuning in this hour. This is Nashville is a production of Nashville Public Radio. Today's episode was produced by Judith Tackett. It was directed by Tasha A.F. Limley. Our technical director and board operator is Liv Lombardi. This series is thanks in part to support from Pinnacle Financial Partners. Music for this series is by Vane Melter. Listen back at thisisnashville.org or wherever you get your podcast. The conversation doesn't end there. Tweet us at This Is Nashville. Find us on Instagram and tell us what you want from our show by filling out our quick survey online. This is Nashville. I'm LaTanya Turner. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And as Khalil would say, be good to each other.